Hello and welcome back to the Paramedic Practitioner Podcast. I'm Andrew Merlman, and today we're going to talk about the pathophysiology and management of hyperkalemia. This is an important, life-threatening diagnosis that I think is frequently missed, but can be readily treated in the field. So we know hyperkalemia is an elevation in the level of potassium in the blood. Typically, potassium likes to live inside of cells, so its plasma concentration is much lower than its intracellular concentration. This is opposite of sodium, which has a much higher plasma concentration and lower intracellular concentration. The normal blood concentration of potassium is 3.5 to 5 millimoles per liter, and contrasted to sodium, which is 135 to 145. When the potassium level is too high, it can cause major problems. The most pressing of which is its cardiac effects, but it can also cause severe muscle weakness, nausea, and vomiting. And a low potassium level or hypokalemia can also cause problems, but that's for another podcast. So what causes hyperkalemia? Well, there are many possible causes, but the most common is probably chronic renal dysfunction. Patients with kidney failure often have persistently high potassium levels, which are typically addressed with dialysis. But a common presentation for EMS is the patient who has missed dialysis and now has elevated potassium, likely among other problems. Hyperkalemia can also be seen in critically ill patients without chronic renal problems. This is due to a number of factors, including acidosis and hypovolemia. Many critically ill patients also develop acute kidney injury, which can cause hyperkalemia on its own. It is also commonly seen in certain phases of diabetic ketoacidosis, and should be treated in these patients as well. But why does acidosis cause hyperkalemia? Well, acidosis is an excess of hydrogen ions in the blood. This creates a gradient between hydrogen in the blood and in the cells. Hydrogen, which is a positively charged ion, will then want to move into the cells through diffusion to balance the gradient. When a hydrogen ion enters the cell, another positively charged ion must leave to maintain a balance in the charge across the cell membrane. So potassium, which is also positively charged, leaves the cell into the blood. Essentially, potassium ions are swapped out of the cells for hydrogen ions. Okay, now let's talk about EKG changes, which is kind of the bread and butter of hyperkalemia diagnosis in the emergency setting. Hyperkalemia is known as the syphilis of EKGs because, like syphilis, which can cause a wide variety of symptoms, hyperkalemia can cause a ton of different EKG changes. But there are some typical findings of hyperkalemia that paramedics must be able to recognize, because if EKG changes are seen, they may be a precursor to ventricular fibrillation and need to be addressed rapidly. The EKG is our best tool pre-hospitally to diagnose hyperkalemia, but it's certainly not perfect. It's important to recognize that there are a large number of hyperkalemic patients who present with no EKG changes. However, the highest risk patients are the ones that do have EKG changes. So let's get into specific changes that are commonly seen. The earliest sign is typically hyperacute or peaked T waves. These T waves are usually narrow but tall and pointy. They're often at least as tall as the R wave in lead V3 and should stand out to you. It's important to note that myocardial infarctions can also present with hyperacute T waves in the early stages, but these are usually wide and fat as well as tall, whereas hyperkalemia T waves are narrow and peaked. So serial EKGs are very useful in both types of patients to assess for progression and changes. As a rule, if you do one EKG, you should do two or more to trend changes. So after you've seen hyperacute T waves, as the potassium rises, you'll see widening of the QRS complex and often the P wave will disappear. This can mimic a ventricular rhythm, however, it will typically be slower than VTAC and will often be wider with pointier T waves. Eventually, the QRS will widen into what is commonly referred to as a sine wave, caused by wide QRS and prominent T wave. This finding precedes ventricular fibrillation and must be addressed immediately. It's important to note that serum potassium levels correlate poorly to EKG findings, which means, for example, a patient with a potassium of 6 will not definitely have one specific EKG finding. Their EKG could be completely normal, or they could have developed a sine wave. It is patient-dependent and may be affected by how rapidly the hyperkalemia developed. In addition to these EKG findings, hyperkalemia is a frequent cause of bradycardia. Any of the findings I described earlier may also be seen along with bradycardia. In a patient with bradycardia of unknown origin, meaning no ongoing MI or other obvious cause, it is reasonable to try treating for hyperkalemia if atropine is ineffective. Okay, so a diagnosis of hyperkalemia should be based on clinical history and the EKG. If we have EKG findings of hyperkalemia and the patient is symptomatic, it is appropriate to treat, and it is essential to treat if hemodynamic instability is present. Okay, so how do we treat it? Most paramedics have the tools necessary to provide temporizing treatment of hyperkalemia. If EKG changes are present, the first line treatment is calcium. You can use calcium chloride or calcium gluconate. Calcium chloride has a 3 times higher concentration of calcium than gluconate does, so chloride is preferred in our patients who are hemodynamically unstable. Calcium does not directly lower potassium levels, but it works by providing myocardial stability. It does this by restoring the gradient between threshold potential and resting membrane potential. In hyperkalemia, the resting membrane potential is abnormally elevated, so calcium will increase the threshold potential to normalize this gradient. The dose for calcium chloride is 1 gram, and the dose for gluconate is 3 grams. The difference is due to the differing concentrations of calcium in the different drugs. These should be both given over 10 minutes. You don't want to push these drugs rapidly, as it will result in adverse cardiac effects. The onset is rapid, and you will typically see improvement in EKG findings pretty quickly. The duration is around 15 to 30 minutes, so you may need to repeat dosing, and you also may need to repeat it if cardiac instability continues to worsen. So the second line treatment for hyperkalemia is insulin. Now, most EMS services do not carry insulin, but if you do, it should be used here. But even if you don't carry it, it's important for everyone to understand why insulin works for hyperkalemia, as this is going to be the first line treatment delivered in the ED when you arrive, and you may see it in the transfer setting as well. Insulin works to shift potassium back into cells where it belongs, so it does actually lower potassium levels, unlike calcium. It does not remove potassium from the body, though, as other longer-term drugs will. Dosing for insulin is 10 units IV and may be followed with an insulin infusion. Boluses may be repeated, and if the blood sugar is less than 250, dextrose should be administered along with the insulin. Our third line treatment, and second line if you don't have insulin available, is albuterol. Beta agonists may cause a small shift of potassium back into the cells by activating the sodium-potassium pump. This requires a lot of albuterol to see an effect. Albuterol should never be a first-line treatment and should not be relied upon to cause an improvement in hemodynamic instability. If you do decide to use it, the dose is 10 to 20 milligrams delivered as a continuous nebulizer. Recognize this is substantially higher than the typical dose of 2.5 milligrams that we give for asthma. Do not bother using albuterol if you cannot give a high enough dose. Sodium bicarbonate is also commonly suggested as a treatment for hyperkalemia. However, the literature suggests that it is not effective when given in ampule form as it is typically stocked. The reason suggested for this is that it is a hypertonic solution, which may cause a phenomenon known as solvent drag, which actually pulls potassium out of the cells. So any potassium-reducing effect that bicarb may have could be counteracted by this solvent drag phenomenon. So bicarbonate should not be viewed as a primary treatment for hyperkalemia. Now, it's important to note, too, if your patient is bradycardic and you suspect that it's due to hyperkalemia, you should try calcium, as I mentioned earlier. If you need to move past calcium and atropine, an epinephrine infusion is a good option. This will directly treat the bradycardia with its beta effects, but it will also work to treat hyperkalemia also through its beta effects, similar to albuterol. Let's also talk about IV fluids in hyperkalemia. IV fluid may help to dilute potassium in the blood and restore volume in the hypovolemic patient. The fluid of choice for hyperkalemia and most other conditions, really, is lactated Ringer's. Now, you may be thinking, doesn't LR have potassium in it? Yes, it does, but it has a low concentration of 4 millimoles per liter. Since the concentration is low, this will actually lower plasma potassium levels because, remember, hyperkalemia is greater than 5 millimoles per liter. Additionally, normal saline will cause a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis, which will further drive potassium out of cells. I think it's also important to note that hyperkalemia should be considered in patients with cardiac arrest. If your patient has a history of renal failure and no identified cause of arrest, giving calcium is probably a good idea. Epinephrine may also help to reduce potassium levels due to its beta effects, as mentioned earlier. So to summarize hyperkalemia, patients often present with weakness, nausea, and potential EKG abnormalities, which include hyperacute T waves and eventual widening of the QRS and deterioration to VFib. Treatment must be initiated in a symptomatic or hemodynamically unstable patient. This includes calcium as first line, insulin if available, and potentially albuterol. Bicarb probably does not have a role in the pre-hospital treatment of hyperkalemia. If a patient remains unstable after calcium, just give more calcium. That's all I have for you today on hyperkalemia. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please let me know if you have any questions, comments, or concerns via email, amerelman@gmail.com, or Twitter, @amerelman. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.